Thank you, counsel. The case is submitted. We'll hear arguments next in Shortan Incorporated against National Labor Relations Board. Flaherty, you may proceed whenever you're ready.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court, is it an unfair labor practice for an employer to ask the Immigration and Naturalization Service to investigate the immigration status of its employees? That is the first and the most important issue presented in this case. Can an employer be required to pay illegal aliens a sum of money equal to 6 months' pay under the National Labor Relations Act, covering a period of time when the illegal aliens are not present in this country, when they are in Mexico and they are not lawfully available for work? That is the second issue presented in this case. And can the National Labor Relations Board require an employer to write reinstatement offers in Spanish and to leave them open for a period of 4 years? That is the third issue presented in this case. The operative facts in this case begin on January 20th, 1977, when Mr. John Shurak, the president of Shortan, wrote this letter to the Immigration and Naturalization Service. He asked the Immigration and Naturalization Service to investigate the immigration status of his employees.
Incidentally, does he know the immigration status of his present employees?
Your Honor, I don't know. I have not asked Mr. Shurak that, and so I just cannot answer that question. In response to this letter, the INS came to Mr. Shurak's facility and investigated the immigration status of the employees. And in response to this letter, it was discovered that the illegal aliens, or that the employees were illegal aliens, five of the eight of them listed on this letter. They were immediately arrested by the INS, and they were permitted to execute an INS form whereby they acknowledged their illegal presence in this country, and then they voluntarily agreed to return to Mexico. The union filed an unfair labor practice charge against the employer, and the labor board returned a complaint charging that Shortan violated Section 8A3 of the National Labor Relations Act by discharging the employees when it sent this letter to the Immigration and Naturalization Service. In an attempt to resolve this dispute, Shortan sent letters offering reinstatement to the employees. They were written in English, and they were sent on March 29, 1977. They asked the employees to report to work by May 1, 1977, if they accepted the offers of reinstatement. In the proceedings below, the Labor Board held that Shortan constructively discharged the employees in violation of Section 8A3 of the Act by sending this letter to the INS requesting the INS investigation. The Board ordered Shortan to offer unconditional reinstatement to the aliens, and it ordered them to pay them back pay. In response to this order, the board's own general counsel filed a motion for clarification, asking the board just what it meant by this order. The General Counsel observed in its motion for clarification that an order that required unconditional reinstatement with back pay, regardless of the alien's immigration status, created a conflict with the immigration laws and policies. It, in effect, served as an incentive for these aliens to re-enter the country illegally. Well, the board denied the motion, but in the decision denying the motion, it said that the back pay should be, the accrual of back pay should be told during the period of time when the illegal aliens were unavailable for lawful employment in this country. The Court of Appeals upheld the order with certain modifications. Under the Court of Appeals enforcement decree, the illegal aliens would have to be reinstated by SureTan only if they can establish at the time they present themselves for employment that they are lawfully available for work in this country. With respect to the back pay issue, the Court of Appeals went way beyond the board. It invented its own remedy, or so-called remedy. It told SureTan that it would have to pay each of these illegal aliens a minimum of 6 months' pay, regardless of whether they were lawfully available for work in this country. Now, this was on the theory that the illegal aliens would have remained in this country illegally for some period of time, but for this request sent to the Immigration and Naturalization Service. The Court of Appeals also held that SureTan would have to write its reinstatement letters in Spanish and would have to leave them open for a period of 4 years. The most important issue facing this court in this case is whether an employer can be held liable under the National Labor Relations Act for reporting a violation of the law to the immigration authorities. This case, or this issue, has already been decided by this court 6 months ago in the Bill Johnson's case. In Bill Johnson's, an employer or employees picketed one of Bill Johnson's restaurants. The owner of that the restaurant told the employees he would get even with them if it was the last thing he did, and he made good on this threat. He filed a civil lawsuit against the employees. This court held that the filing of a civil lawsuit was protected under the First Amendment right to petition the government, regardless of the employer's motive for filing that lawsuit. That is precisely the issue that is presented in this case. SureTan's request to the Immigration and Naturalization Service was squarely within the First Amendment right to petition the government, just as was the lawsuit filed by Bill Johnson's restaurants.
Found as a matter of fact that the employer acted solely because of his opposition to the union and the employee's desire to have a union. What if it were found that was the sole reason for his going to the INS?
If that were found, it would make no difference, Your Honor. The right of a citizen of this country to report a violation of the law is not conditioned upon the person's motive for reporting that violation of the law.
Well, let's assume that in the abstract that that's correct. In its interaction with labor relations, isn't the board entitled to draw some inferences from the conduct?
Well, certainly, Your Honor, and it does so in every case that involves
motive. It did so here.
Yes, it did so here.
The board said, in effect, all right, this is an exercise of your right to petition the government, but in the circumstances in which you exercise that right, it has some other meaning to us.
In essence,
isn't that what they did?
That's what they did, Your Honor. They said that, yes, you have a First Amendment, well, they did not address this directly, but assuming there is a First Amendment right to petition the government, which certainly there is, they said, we are going to condition that right on your motive for exercising that constitutional right. And never before has this court ever conditioned the right to exercise a constitutional right on a person's motive for doing so. Indeed, if administrative agencies,
that there was an anti-union motive somewhere in this set of facts.
I cannot put myself in Mr. Shurak's head, but I can certainly tell you there was a dispute between the union and the company, just as there was in Bill Johnson's restaurant.
Well,
and
now,
that
now, so there was a the employer was motivated by an anti-union bias. I know that that isn't the end of the case. I know, but
certainly not. And
but there was that in the case.
That was found below.
Yes, yes.
And that is not relevant, however,
and
with
sustained and enforced.
That is not relevant, however, with respect to the right to exercise the constitutional right to report a violation of the law.
Well, now, Mr. Flanagan, are you sure that the right to turn in aliens to the illegal aliens to the INS can be equated with filing a lawsuit in state court the way you had in Bill Johnson's for constitutional purposes?
Very definitely, Justice Rehnquist. Under the Knorr-Pennington Doctrine, this court has held repeatedly in many cases that efforts to enforce the law, whether they be through the filing of lawsuits, through petitioning, or through lobbying to seek stricter enforcement of the law by law enforcement agencies or other petitions to the government, are within the First Amendment right to petition the government. And in the 4-0 Precision Metal case, which is cited in our reply brief, that precise issue was addressed by the Ninth Circuit. It was a petition to the police by IBM for them to enforce the law that led to the indictment of 14 people. And the Ninth Circuit held squarely that that was within the First Amendment right to petition the government.
But, Mr. Flaherty, isn't there a difference in the facts here? At the time the letter was written that you've exhibited to us two or three times, your client didn't know whether there had been a violation of the law, did he?
He had heard, he had had reports several months earlier.
He listed other people beside these who were not, in fact, illegal aliens.
That is correct, Your Honor.
So he really didn't know which were and which were not.
He had received reports that that some of these employees were present illegally.
But he sort of just tossed a bunch over and said, look at all of them.
He had asked the employees after the election, before this letter was written, whether they were present, legally, and a number of them said no, they weren't. So he did know at that time. At the time he wrote the letter, he did, Your Honor.
Does the record show that?
Yes, it does, okay. Your Honor. Yes.
Mr. Flaherty, in Bill Johnson's, is it possible it should be distinguished because there the employer was trying to assert in state court an alleged injury to the employer's own reputation? The employer himself had suffered an injury that otherwise would not be redressed, and perhaps that is not the case here.
The holding in Bill Johnson's focused on the First Amendment right to petition the government, and it said for that reason, as well as for
well,
the
I think
state.
The opinion yes. also focused on the fact that the employer would have been left with no forum in which to pursue a remedy for an actual injury to the employer. Does that distinguish this case?
I don't think so, Your Honor. I think the First Amendment right to petition the government stands on its own, and that this court recognized that in Bill Johnson's. That was another factor that was present, but it was not a necessary factor. It was not necessary to this court's decision in Bill Johnson's.
Well, it was certainly discussed by the court and apparently relied upon.
It was discussed. It was relied upon. But either one of those grounds, the First Amendment right to petition the government or the state's compelling interest in the maintenance of public peace, were involved. And, in fact, in this case, the reporting of a violation of the law is just as essential to the maintenance of the public peace as the filing of a civil lawsuit was in Bill Johnson's. If anything, the right to report a violation to law enforcement agencies is more important to the public peace.
It was against the union.
I'm sorry.
The complaint was against the union.
No, the letter, Justice Marshall,
I'm not talking about the letter. I'm talking about Suntan's complaint. It only came about when the union tried to organize.
That
correct.
This letter was written after the union won the election. That is correct.
And that's what brought it on.
This petition to the government is what brought on this case. That is correct.
Well, was the letter brought on by the election?
It was written after the union won the election.
It came after the election.
That's correct. After
and
the union won the election.
Before the election, everything was hunky-dory.
Well, before the election, it was after the election that he asked the employees whether they were illegally present here, and they admitted that they were illegally present here. Once he knew that, then he wrote the letter. That is correct.
Well, the board and the lower courts drew the inference from the factual situation, though, that he was animated by anti-union animus in doing this.
That is,
certainly we don't review that.
No, we're not reviewing that. We're not asking for that fact determination to be reviewed here. That determination is irrelevant with respect to the right to report a violation of the law. In the Quarles case, this court observed that a person's right to report a violation of the law to law enforcement agencies was one of the essential privileges and immunities which arises out of the essential character of our form of government, which must be constitutionally protected, regardless of a person's motive for seeking enforcement of the law.
What have lower courts done in the labor law area about instances where an employer has reported an employee out of an anti-union animus to law enforcement officers for commission of a crime? Maybe it's theft or assault or whatever it is.
Justice O'Connor, I'm not aware of any other cases. This is a case of first impression, to my knowledge, in this situation.
I think it may be in this court, but have there not been some other cases below in the dealing with reporting of criminal violations? You're not aware of any?
I am not aware of any, no.
Johnson, was it the issue that whether the board could enjoin the holding of the prosecution of the suit or not?
That is correct. And it was alleged that the suit was brought in retaliation for the employees exercising their right to engage in concerted protected activities, and in retaliation for their having filed a complaint. And that's precisely what's presented here. It's alleged that Shertan's actions were undertaken in retaliation for these employees having voted in a union. It's precisely the same situation. And the First Amendment right to petition the government that was present in Bill Johnson's is present here as well. And drawing from the Norr Pennington line of cases, this court has held that the right to seek enforcement of the law is privileged under the First Amendment, regardless of why the actions were taken to enforce the law, as long as those actions were not a sham. And in Bill Johnson's, this court held that a sham would mean that there would have to be no reasonable basis for the actions taken.
Mr. Flaherty, is it illegal for an employer to hire illegal aliens?
No, it is not, Justice Blackmun.
Well, if you prevail here, then isn't a way to avoid the confines of the Labor Act just to keep hiring illegal aliens, and when one gets into a labor bind, report them to the INS?
Your Honor, in this case, Shertan is subject to, they voted in the union. The union stayed recognized. It has to bargain with the union. That was not a way out of a union recognition situation. The union didn't go away. It stayed there. Furthermore, there's a back pay and reinstatement liability that is faced here.
Without committing an unfair labor practice, could you have fired the illegal aliens for the reason that they were illegal aliens?
For the reason they were illegal aliens, certainly. Certainly.
And that would be a firing for cause under the collective bargaining agreement was one?
There was not a collective bargaining.
I said if there was one, could an employer fire an employee because he's an illegal?
That would depend upon the arbitration case law, and I have not read arbitration cases covering that, but I would certainly think that firing an illegal alien because he's an illegal alien would be just cause.
Even after the union won an election?
Yes, it would. Yes, I definitely think it would.
So you would say that if one of the reasons for firing a person is that he's an illegal alien, and another reason is because he's a member of the union, that it's not an unfair labor practice?
Definitely not. In this case, he had a right
Definitely
to...
Definitely not what? Is not
it is not an unfair labor practice in this case because he had a right to report a violation of the law.
Well, I would...
A First Amendment right to...
I would think it would be a fortiori in this case if you're right in my example. You say the employer could even fire an illegal alien himself. He doesn't complain to the government at all. He just fires him. Says, you're an illegal alien, you're fired. But by the way, I'm also firing you because... you're a member of the union. And you say that would not be an unfair labor practice.
Oh, if there is anti-union animus?
Yeah.
I would say, no, then there would be an unfair labor
why?
Practice.
Why?
Because in that case, you are not reporting a violation of the law. You are not exercising a constitutionally protected right. In this case, you are exercising a constitutional...
You're enforcing the law yourself, then. That's... The employer would be expelling the person instead of having the INS do it.
Well, no, in this case, the enforcement of the law came by reporting it properly to the law enforcement agency. If you just fired them, you would not be aiding the INS in the enforcement
of
the law.
But you say you would be privileged to fire them without committing an unfair labor practice.
You did not mention that there was anti-union animus in your hypothetical.
Let's say there was not an anti-union animus, but there was a collective bargaining agreement that says you can't fire except for just cause. And he fires a bunch of employees because they're illegal aliens. You say he has that privilege under the collective bargaining contract.
Well, interpretation of a collective bargaining contract depends upon arbitration case law and the past history of the parties and so forth.
What is that law, you think? May you fire?
I definitely think that they could fire under that circumstance. Yes,
but you couldn't fire them for that reason if... you also fire them for being a member of the union.
Well, that would violate the labor laws. Mm-hmm. But this case is distinguishable, quite distinguishable from that hypothetical, because in our situation, there was a report made to a law enforcement agency reporting a violation of the law. And that, as this court held in the Quarles case, is one of the fundamental privileges and immunities of all citizens. It is clearly within the First Amendment
Fleury,
right
may
to
I ask a follow-up on Justice Blackmun's question.
Sure.
You responded by pointing out in this case there was a remedy that was possible. But just as the general problem, would it not be true that if you prevail, an employer would be well advised to hire illegal aliens before they're organized and let them know promptly that if they do organize, they'll be reported. If they don't organize, they won't be. Wouldn't that be good? Seems to me make a lot of sense for a businessman who wants to have inexpensive, unorganized labor. Maybe that's fine. I don't know. But isn't that would be a natural consequence of your position, isn't it?
Regardless of how this court holds, Your Honor, it is a possible consequence. Yes. But if this court were to hold that is an unfair labor practice to report a crime to the law enforcement agency, that would not end this problem at all. Human nature being what it is, employers would make a telephone call.
The result for which you're arguing would encourage the employment of illegal aliens by unorganized employers. That much is clear, I guess.
It is a possible consequence. It is not an essential consequence.
Which might encourage more illegal aliens to come to the country.
People hire illegal aliens for a number of reasons, whether it be to perform work that other people don't want to do because they work for less money. There are a large number of reasons why people hire illegal aliens.
But you think we should encourage the practice?
Certainly not. And I'm not saying
that the result for which you're arguing, I think you've acknowledged, would encourage the practice.
It's possible. It's possible. With respect to there's also a fundamental conflict in this case with the immigration laws presented by the board's order. In effect, the board is holding Shertan liable under the labor laws for assisting in the enforcement of the immigration laws. Now, this just cannot be. You cannot be held liable under one set of laws for helping enforce other laws. And this court noted in the Southern Steamship case that the labor laws have to be interpreted and enforced in consonance with the immigration laws. And to hold someone liable under one law for enforcing another violates the Southern Steamship mandate. Now, with regard to the back pay award, as we have argued, there was no violation of the National Labor Relations Act by exercising the constitutional right to report a violation of the law. There should be no back pay award. But under any circumstance, the award of back pay, 6 months' pay, to illegal aliens covering a period of time when they are not lawfully available for work in this country is wholly inappropriate. The board itself acknowledged that this was improper. They would have told the accrual of back pay during the time that the illegal aliens were not available for employment because of enforced absence from this country. Yet the Court of Appeals invented its own remedy. It came up with a 6 month back pay, essentially what was a fine that was imposed on Sure-Tan. There's no reasonable basis for this 6 month back pay award. It's based on pure speculation. And as Judge Wood noted in his dissent, the rationale behind this back pay award seems to be to punish Sure-Tan for what it did.
What if the only remedy the board imposed was an order to reinstate once the company, once the alien is back in the country legally?
That would comport with immigration laws, certainly.
Well, what about the labor law?
That would comport with the labor laws as well.
I know, but that would leave a remedy standing, a remedy which is premised on an unfair labor practice. Now, you say there's no unfair labor practice at all.
Well, assuming, contrary to fact, that there was an unfair labor practice,
I'm just saying, in this very case, if the only remedy that had been imposed by the board was an order to reinstate if and when the alien is back in the country legally, now you would still be here, I take it, because that remedy would be, the predicate for that remedy would be an unfair labor practice. Was the fact that there was an unfair labor practice?
That's right. Certainly, we feel that there was not an unfair labor practice, and there should be no remedy. There's no need for a remedy.
Well, I know, the board could have had full regard for the labor board and for the immigration laws, and you still would be here.
If they had full regard for the immigration laws, then they would not have, first of all, they would not have imposed back pay for a period of time when they were not lawfully available for work.
I guess what I'm asking really is that the Court of Appeals may have been wrong in some of its remedy decisions, but that doesn't mean it was wrong in saying there was an unfair labor practice.
Oh, I certainly think they were wrong in saying there was an unfair labor
practice. But you're making two different
arguments. Yes, I am making two different arguments.
One, that there was no unfair labor practice because of the board's failure to integrate with the immigration laws. And second, even if there was an unfair labor practice, that the Court of Appeals' substitution of a remedy was improper, even if there was a violation.
That's correct. Assuming arguendo there was a violation, then the remedy was clearly erroneous. There should not have been an imposition of an arbitrary 6 month back pay award during a period of time when the illegal aliens weren't available for work, because the board, under its normal procedures, would toll back pay. Indeed, that's what it wanted to do in its decision denying the motion for clarification. It said back pay should be tolled when the illegal aliens are not available for work. And certainly the illegal aliens should not be
But the board, under the board's order, wouldn't the tolling of back pay be ended if the alien came back in the country illegally and was available for work?
I would certainly hope so.
Well, I know, but under the terms of its order, the alien wouldn't have to be back here legally.
Well, I think if they are not lawfully available for work is how I interpret that. I think it certainly, if there's any ambiguity in what they advised, it should be construed that way. Otherwise, they would have an incentive to come here illegally in order to prevent the tolling of back pay so that they could keep the meter running by being here illegally. And that certainly would conflict with the immigration laws.
Of course, you object to the ALJ's 4 weeks back pay as much as you do to the Seventh Circuit's longer period, don't you?
Definitely. Definitely. In essence, what it does is it conflicts with immigration laws. It treats them as though they had a legal right to remain here for 4 weeks or 6 months, even though they were not lawfully here to begin with and they were returned to Mexico. In essence, any back pay covering a period of time when they were not available for work treats the immigration laws as if they were of no consequence. And that type of a conflict with the immigration laws violates this court's mandate in Southern Steamship that the remedies of the board have to comport with other fundamental constitution or congressional objectives, those in the immigration laws. Now, with respect to the reinstatement offers, never before has the board required an employer to communicate with its employees in a foreign language. And yet, in this case, it tells SureTan that it has to communicate in writing with these employees in Spanish. It has to hire an interpreter to talk to these people. The government is not even required to communicate with its citizens in a foreign language. It is just fundamentally unfair and wrong to require a private employer to communicate with employees in Spanish when the government isn't even required to do so. In fact, there are board cases.
How did the employer communicate with them on the job?
By attempts to a combination of, I believe, English and Spanish. He got the message across, pointing, and I really can't say because I wasn't there, but it was a rather primitive communication, I would imagine. With respect to the four-year reinstatement offer, never before has the board required that reinstatement offers be left open for a period of 4 years. Traditionally, the board has upheld reinstatement offers that have been held open for...
On this question about the Spanish letter, there were about a dozen employees, right?
There were 11 employees, five of whom were...
And how much would it cost to translate one letter...
I couldn't speak to that.
About a dollar and a quarter, I guess, something like that. How about the minimum?
The courts have held, and our brief points out cases to the effect, that the government is not required to communicate in a foreign language with its citizens. And yet, the board would impose that upon SureTan, contrary to its prior cases. It changes its own precedent without any warning. And with regard to the four-year reinstatement, that also is contrary to established precedent. Now, in conclusion, this case presents the exact same issue that was presented to this court in Bill Johnson's restaurant. As this court decided in Bill Johnson's restaurant, it should hold that SureTan had a constitutional right to report a violation of the law and that it did not commit an unfair labor practice by doing so. Thank you.
Mr. Nadler.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court. Before beginning, I'd like to emphasize 2 points. One, in response to Mr. Justice White's question, this was a case in which the board held that the employer was motivated solely by anti-union animus. We don't view that as an essential attribute of the violation under transportation management. The test would be whether the employer would have done it even in the absence of the anti-union animus. But here the court found that aggravated circumstance. And secondly, in petitioner's brief on the merits, they acknowledged that they were not challenging the board's finding of anti-union animus in the circumstances of this case. Now, this court recognized in Plywood versus Doe and in United States versus Brignone-Ponce that illegal aliens are especially vulnerable to exploitation by employers. And in the Canis, the court recognized that the acceptance by illegal aliens of jobs on substandard conditions has the effect of depressing the wages and working conditions of lawfully resident American workers and also undermines the effectiveness of labor unions. We submit that the
appropriate accommodation of the National Labor Relations Act and the immigration laws in the circumstances of this case requires a recognition of those realities.
Mr. Needle, yes. I'm interested to know whether the government takes the position that the board's result here can be defended only in the circumstances of the immigration laws. Let's suppose that I'm Mr. Shurak and I have this outfit in Chicago and that an effort is made to unionize my employees. And I hire a private investigator to find out what I can get on the people who are leading the union investigation move. I find that one of them, who is an employee, is a fugitive from Indiana. He's escaped from prison in Indiana, not on any immigration charge, on an armed robbery charge. Now, the reason I've made the investigation in the first place is I want to hurt the union if I can. I'm an employer, and I don't want to be unionized. Is it an unfair labor practice for me at that point to turn him into Illinois authorities to be extradited to Indiana?
Oh, that would present much different considerations. Our position here depends not just on a construction of the National Labor Relations Act, but also the policies with respect to employment that are reflected in the other federal statute, the immigration laws. The proper accommodation would have to look to the other statute that the employer was seeking to assist in the enforcement of, and for instance, the fact that it was a felony, a serious crime, a fugitive, and also I think it's appropriate to consider the particular utility of this device to employers, as Mr. Justice Stevens was pointing out, the utility of this device to employers to avoid the policies of the Labor Act. I think that those same policies would not be present with respect to
another. Well, but the obligation of the employer, at least by statute and case law, is much the same. The Ninth Circuit has held, hasn't it, that the employer has an obligation to notify the INS in these circumstances.
Well, what the Ninth Circuit suggested in the passage that has been quoted by petitioners is really that it's not the board's function to enforce the immigration laws by excluding illegal aliens or determining the documentation of illegal aliens and excluding them from board protection, that the employer should take that problem to the Immigration Service if that's his point, that he wants to help enforce the immigration laws. I don't think the Ninth Circuit purported to suggest that the employer should have an absolute immunity from his obligations under the Labor Act to do so for anti-union reasons, if that was the motivation. I think the Ninth Circuit was making a much different point, that the enforcement of the immigration laws is essentially the responsibility of INS.
Well, Rehnquist's example of the felon, the fugitive, would all the board have to do is find that the employer wouldn't have fired him except for an anti-union animus? And wouldn't have turned him in except for that? Is that all they have to find an unfair labor practice?
Well, that's ordinarily what
he gets on the stand. He testified. Well, why did you turn him in? I turned him in because he was a ringleader in this movement towards the union. But of course, when I found out he was a felon, I could easily get rid of him. So I turned him in.
Well,
is that all the board would have to find?
Again, I think that because of this...
Well, that's all there is.
Well, in finding the normal unfair labor practice, that's true. Well, but my question, or my point is that there may be...
What's abnormal about that?
Well, nothing if one looks only to the purposes of the immigration laws. My only point was that, as in Bill Johnson's, the court sometimes feels that it must look outside the immigration or outside the Labor Act to see whether there are countervailing considerations, what the court said in Bill Johnson's, that might preclude the board from finding an unfair labor practice, even when
so
the other...
So the policy of enforcing the laws against murder or something are stronger than enforcing the immigration laws?
Well, and that...
Is that a critical part of your submission, that the interest in enforcing the immigration laws just isn't that strong?
No, certainly the Department of Justice...
One crime is different than another?
No, but there are
the
other.
The board is entitled to weigh each crime and make the final decision for the whole country as to what laws ought to
No, be no. What we're suggesting is, with particular reference to the National Labor Relations Act, the board has never found an unfair labor practice in any other circumstances, insofar as I'm aware, where an employer has reported
So your answer is yes, it does make it, the board does sit to decide which laws are to be ignored and which are not.
No, I...
Well, it can pick out the immigration laws at least, you say.
Well, it's not the board's own assessment of that. This is the position of the United States in this case, that there are countervailing policies reflected in the Immigration Act that reinforce the board's construction of the Labor Act in these circumstances.
You mean that sometime it's all right to not to report illegal aliens?
Well, absent an anti-union animus and really, in a sense, an abuse of the reporting process, it would ordinarily be entirely appropriate in the responsibility of an employer or any other citizen to report. What we're suggesting is that the policies of the immigration laws are designed to protect
America. But he has to be able to prove he loves the union before he can turn an illegal alien in.
No, the initial burden is on the board to establish an anti-union animus.
Let's try another one. He knew all along for 20 years that this man was a felon. And when the man joined the union, he blew the whistle on it.
Well, again, it might depend on the application of misprision of felony statutes, which is another consideration that would apply in the area of murder or any other felony. It's a federal crime, and I would assume a crime under the law of most states not to report a felony. So if we're talking about an employer who has knowledge of a felon in his employ, that countervailing policy and the legislative judgment reflecting those statutes about reporting a felony, I think might well override the finding of an unfair labor practice in those circumstances.
You support your position, could support your position by saying that, of course, there's a duty to report illegal activity. There's a civic duty, and there's a First Amendment right to do it on the edges of that. But that the National Labor Relations Board isn't concerned about civic duty or other factors, if there is an anti-union animus, that supports their position no matter what the other considerations are. Would that take care of you?
Well, that would control this case, yes.
Well, even more than you
right
ask.
Across the board.
Yes,
that
that's
even a felon too.
That's right, and so we are not urging the court to adopt a broad rule like that. We're eliminating felonies here. The only crime that an alien who enters the United States illegally in the vast majority of cases commits is a misdemeanor. I don't want to denigrate the fact it's a misdemeanor, but Congress has ranked the offenses, and the board can take some guidance.
Mr. Needler,
from that. Yes.
In the example you've been discussing for the last 5 minutes, let's assume that the felon who had escaped from Illinois or wherever it was and was sent back and put in prison for 4 years. Would the board have had authority to demand that he be reinstated at the end of the 4 years?
Well, we would first have to determine whether the board could find an unfair labor practice.
Let's assume that, as I think Justice Rehnquist said, in reporting this fellow, the employer said quite candidly, he was a leader of this anti-union movement, so I thought I'd better report him, get him off my back.
Well, I suggested that in the case of a felony or a murder, a crime like that, that the board, although it hasn't addressed it.
The board would have to reinstate him after.
Well, no, I'm suggesting there may not be a violation in those circumstances, so the question of reinstatement would never be reached.
I don't quite see the distinction. Why wouldn't the board not only require the reemployment at the end of 4 years, but also compel the employer to send him 6 months back pay to the prison?
Well, the board does not reach the question of remedy, either reinstatement or back pay, until it is first found that the employer has violated the act. And in the situation of a felon and the employer's reporting of a felon, if the board did not find, for the reasons that I've suggested, that the employer had violated the Labor Act, then there would be no occasion to impose a remedy. But in this situation where the board does find a violation of the Act, as here, because of the appropriate accommodation of the two statutes leads to that result, then it is appropriate for the board to consider the normal remedies, which are, under 10C of the Act, reinstatement with or without back pay. And then at that point, the board would determine whether reinstatement and back pay were appropriate in light of the policies of the statute that the employers relied upon. So
that wouldn't encourage people to report crime, would it?
Well,
they might be caught in the middle between a legal obligation to report it, quite apart from the First Amendment, and what you say the board might feel free to do.
Well, but in these circumstances, I think it's important to stress the narrowness of the rule we're suggesting.
Are you saying that the only crime to which your argument applies is where one employs an illegal alien and then discharges him?
That's all that is presented here, and that's all we are submitting here.
I understand that, but it seems to me the principle that you advocate is not going to be easy to cabin.
Well, there are affirmative indications in the purposes and background of the immigration laws to reinforce that conclusion here, purposes that I would think would be absent under most state criminal codes and a commission of a murder or something like that. I mean, Congress has enacted two statutes that have to be given due consideration by the board and the court. And Congress fashioned an express exemption for employment of illegal aliens insofar as employers are concerned. It did that at the same time it was strengthening, it said, the laws against illegal immigration into the United States by enacting a prohibition against harboring, but Congress carved out employers from that prohibition. Now, obviously, Congress did not expect that the very employers who would take advantage of that immunity would turn around and report the employers immediately upon doing so, and thereby sacrifice whatever advantage they had acquired by hiring the illegal aliens.
I'm not so sure that it's just the immigration law. I think it's the whole Title 18.
Well, but in the immigration laws, there is the affirmative support for the decision of the Court of Appeals in this case, and in the typical Title 18 offense, I would think you could not find.
Well, maybe
that
you'd help
support.
Me. You tell me exactly what was the violation of the labor law.
In this case, the violation of the labor law was the reporting of the illegal aliens to the INS in retaliation for their union activities.
Well, why wouldn't that apply to the report of spitting on the sidewalk?
Well, if I could go back to let me go back to Bill Johnson's, and really what petitioner is really arguing here is that there's an implied exception from the labor laws for his conduct because of the policy favoring reporting of crimes and the policy of enforcing the immigration laws. And the question is whether the court should recognize an implied exception for retaliatory conduct that would otherwise be a violation of the Act. And that requires looking to the competing statute. And here it's a violation because the policies of the competing of the other statute, the immigration laws, are affirmatively furthered by them.
Or the Constitution.
Well, petitioners do rely on the Constitution.
Well, what about that?
I would note in the first instance that they did not raise that before the board, before the Court of Appeals, or in the petition for certiorari here. Putting that objection to one side, I think, again, going back to Bill Johnson's and the distinctions between that case and this are instructive.
Well, what about the Knorr-Pennington line of cases generally? Certainly, there have been other competing laws involved, such as the antitrust laws, and it's been claimed that companies or a litigant has resorted to the courts deliberately to discourage competition or to get them out of business. It's been held that the resort to their utilization of the legal processes are constitutionally guaranteed.
Well, in those cases, those cases have involved, as in Knorr itself, political activity, which is at the core of the right of petition. Political activity.
About California Transport or whatever that was.
Yes, that was an invocation of the adjudicative process before an administrative agency. And what the companies were doing in those circumstances, what fits within the language of the First Amendment and fits within this Court's decision in Bill Johnson. They were petitioning for a redress of their grievances. And as Justice O'Connor pointed out, a grievance was, in a sense, a redress of a legal injury to themselves.
So your answer to the constitutional claim is there's just no constitutional right, protected constitutional right, to report a crime.
No, our submission does not have to go that far. Our submission is that it is not an absolute right. And where the employer does it in retaliation for other protected activities by the person who's being reported, that there is not an absolute right to do so. It must be remembered that the employee's activities here, while protected by the National Labor Relations Act, also have constitutional overtones. The right of association and to organize in the area of employment are also constitutionally protected. So the employer's reporting of the violation was in response to activities that also have constitutional overtones.
Well, but certainly it wasn't the employer's reporting may have had an indirect effect on those activities, but since the activities were being conducted by people who had no business being in the country, I don't see how you can fault the employer on that account.
Well,
I mean, it was the government that expelled the people. The employer did.
But the employer brought it about and concededly, in this court, did so for solely for anti-union reasons. And in terms of the constitutional right, in In re Quarles and Butler, which opposing counsel has cited, the court did not suggest that a right to inform about violations of the law derives from the First Amendment. In fact, Quarles was a prosecution under Section 241 of Title 18 for a conspiracy to interfere with rights protected by the Constitution or laws of the United States. And what was involved in that case was whether the federal government could protect its own processes by prosecuting people who, in that case, murdered someone who informed on a violation of federal law. And so the very essence of federal sovereignty was involved to recognize that the constitutional the Constitution required the federal government to protect informants.
Mr. Needle, yes. May I ask another question? Am I correct in understanding that the Court of Appeals ordered the company to pay 6 months back pay regardless of whether or not the former employee returned legally to the United States?
That's correct. The Court of Appeals ordered a minimum 6 month back pay.
Well, let's assume, for example, that one of these employees called up the employer and said, I'm now back in the United States. I've got a good job down in St. Louis. Will you send me that 6 months pay, please? And the employer said, well, look, are you lawfully in the United States again at this time? And the fellow said, no, he said, I don't have to be lawfully here to get my money. Could the employer report him then and not pay the money? I guess he'd have to pay it under the Court of Appeals.
Yeah, I would, unless it were shown that the employer was acting for some anti-union reason under the court's decision, he could, and it would. I'm not sure what the anti-union reason would be after the employee had long since left.
Did the court come up with it by itself?
The board had not ordered it in its decision. The ALJ had recommended that the board consider some minimum award of back pay.
Who brought it up in the Court of Appeals? Anybody?
I think it was sua sponte.
And are you defending that here?
Yes, we are in this case. The board did not purport to adopt a general policy to govern all such cases, but it did accept the...
Ordinarily, isn't it the board's job, not the court's, to specify the remedy?
That's correct. And as we point out...
Why is it all right for the Court of Appeals here to do something that the board hadn't done?
Well, we don't suggest that it is, as we in fact
you're defending it, you said.
Well, the board was in this particular case, the board was willing to accept the suggestion on remand and to adopt that. So as far as the 6 month back pay, that is the board's position in this case.
Well, that's the order finally entered by
the
board?
Well, the board proposed a judgment to the Court of Appeals, and that was the Court of Appeals judgment in the particular case. It did not go back for new proceedings.
Is that often done?
I think it's quite unusual.
They don't order back pay to someone who isn't available for work, do they?
No.
Somebody out of the country who can't legally enter. It's an extraordinary thing to order. How can you defend that?
The employee's unavailability for work is directly attributable to the employer's unfair labor practice. And under the board's policies, where the employer has caused the employee's unavailability for work because of injury,
remedies are not supposed to be punitive. They're supposed to help the employee, but they're not normally extended when the employee is unavailable for work. It just seems like a most unusual.
What I'm suggesting, though, is that even where the employee is unavailable, if the employer is responsible for causing the unavailability, the board has in the past approved the award of back pay. And here the employer is responsible for the employee's unavailability.
Yeah,
now, to be sure, the alien is too.
Doesn't that encourage, as Justice Powell suggested, another illegal entry to come and see about the money? And doesn't that fly right in the face of our immigration policies?
No, the award of the back pay in this case is not contingent upon the aliens reentering the country. The back pay award would be paid to the alien even if he remained in Mexico, assuming that he could be found. That's correct.
Well, that's just a fine then for violating the law.
It's not a fine. No, I don't. I think it's quite different from a fine, because the ordinary remedy in a unfair labor practice discriminatory discharge case is reinstatement and back pay. The employment relationship between the employer and the employee here was not unlawful insofar as federal law is concerned. The alien had an illegal status, but the employment relationship was not unlawful. Because it was not, then it is not contrary to the immigration laws to recognize that employment relationship and apply the normal back pay remedy.
So the employer ought to just feel lucky that it was confined to 6 months.
Well,
because the employment relation hasn't been legally terminated yet. And back pay ought to run forever.
Well, we certainly don't suggest back pay should run forever, and the six-month
as much reason for running it at a year as the 6 months, on your theory.
Well, at some point, the amount of the back pay might become so substantial that concerns about its being punitive, rather than simply remedial, might be raised. But indeed, 6 months may be toward the outer limit of the amount of back pay that should be awarded. Maybe the ALJ's decision as a general rule would be more appropriate. But if there is no back pay awarded, then the employer has really no financial disincentive to evade the purposes of the immigration laws in these circumstances.
Over the years, said that we pay great deference to the labor board provisions for remedy and things of that kind, because they are dealing with it all the time and they develop what we call expertise. What expertise does the Court of Appeals have in these areas?
Well, generally none, and as I suggested...
Not the same as ours, wouldn't it be?
Well, the board is the expert agency, and as a rule, the matter ought to be remanded to the board.
And the courts of appeals, all appellate courts ought to leave remedies, the devising of remedies, to the agency that's very experienced and can understand its impact on the whole system rather than just one aberration of this kind.
That's correct. And but in the a remedy such as this, we think is entirely appropriate because, again, deferring to the board's expertise, the normal rule is that unless there is some effort to make the employee whole, the purposes of the act will not be effectuated, which Section 10C requires.
There's legislation pending in Congress to make it illegal, make it an unlawful act, a crime, to hire an undocumented alien. Suppose that legislation passed. Would the board or anybody else be entitled to make a remedy that would give back pay?
Well, we would certainly think not.
Not if they pass that legislation.
No, if the employment, in those circumstances, the employment relationship would then become illegal. And for the board to order the reinstatement of an employee to an illegal relationship and to pay him inconsistent with such a statute would clearly be improper. But as I said, the employment relationship is not illegal under the immigration laws.
Let me go back to that this dichotomy that seemed to be this. Interesting, everyone, about the employer doing the noble, patriotic, and altruistic thing in reporting these illegal aliens. The Labor Board historically has penalized employers or unions for doing good things if they were in violation of the act. Hasn't that been so?
That's
in other words, suppose the employer on the day before Christmas and there's an election coming up sends a caterer out with a complete Christmas dinner for every employee and maybe a case of scotch along with it. Presumably he's doing a
right.
Good Christian thing, but he might get in trouble with the Labor Board for doing that. Maybe
well,
that, not.
That's right. There are that. That's correct. The Labor Act does attach consequences to things that would otherwise be entirely lawful.
So when he reports the criminal conduct of his employees being here illegally, he's doing the patriotic and civic duty, but he might get penalized for that properly, too.
That's correct, and we suggest
that. You aren't asking for all of that. That's more than you asked for.
Yes, we're not saying everything that every report he makes, but in the circumstances of this case, we think believe that that's entirely appropriate. I would like to address Bill Johnson's and the First Amendment issue for just a moment, if I could. The First Amendment, by its terms, refers to petitioning for redress of grievances. That's what was going on in Bill Johnson's because the employer went to court to try to get a remedy for a legal injury. That is not this case. There was no legal injury suffered by the employer here. The other distinguishing factor, countervailing consideration in Bill Johnson's, was the deeply rooted interest of the states in providing a remedy for wrongs. That federalism question is not presented here. A last distinguishing factor is that the employer himself knowingly facilitated the employment of the illegal aliens in this case. It does not come with good graces, I submit, for the employer to then turn around and rely on the immigration laws whose violation he is encouraged as a basis for avoiding liability under the labor laws. This is not the first occasion in which these concerns have been raised, even with this employer. This employer was the subject of prior unfair labor practice proceedings in 1973, in which the board then found that, except for a few senior employees, all of the employer's employees were Mexican nationals, and on that occasion, the employer again had intimidated his Mexican employees by making it clear that they would be fired and he would hire another one if they supported the union. So this case highlights very strongly the concerns that underlie our submission here, and that is that if, as Justice Stevens pointed out, that an employer would have a powerful incentive and weapon to hire aliens in violation of the immigration laws if the decision of the Court of Appeals were reversed in these circumstances. And that would subvert the purposes of both the labor laws and of the immigration statutes.
And on what the Court said, if it reversed, might it not?
Well, I was referring to if the Court were to find that this was not an unfair labor practice in this case.
Very well, thank you, gentlemen. The case is submitted.
The Honorable Justice Robert J.